Welcome to the Coach Haas Podcast, powered by Sports Rehab PA, along with our sponsors.
By Optimizers Masszymes, 100% plant-based, naturally derived, best digestive enzyme blend out there right now. Highly concentrated with enzymes that digest proteins, starches, sugars, fibers, and fats. Helps to relieve indigestion, gas, bloating, and fatigue after meals. Take it with the meals to enhance the digestion and nutrient absorption. Also helps to improve recovery after hard exercise and hard efforts. So go to buyoptimizers.com and use code JUICY for 10% off. Kaelor Core Training Systems. The Kaelor Core Column Training is the next step in the evolution of strength development, preventing training injuries, and elevating core fitness to maximize athletic performance. The column core is used to help remap the central motor patterns for functional movements to ensure that the movement quality is efficient before loads and demands. Helps to increase strength, flexibility, and speed by 16%, reduces training injuries by 75%, works quickly in 6 short weeks, helps to strengthen the core and the back. Used with multiple Olympic-level athletes, NCAA athletes, as well as pro athletes in the NFL and other sports. Visit KaelorCore.com to find out more about the training systems. Also, check out Fit Life and Sports Rehab, Ivy Rehab, for understanding the systems as well in this facility.
This is a podcast that was inspired by our curiosity in several areas, and some of those include sports performance, sports injury, team training, recovery nutrition, ACL rehab and recovery, personal development, and fitness entrepreneurship. We also have a 15-minute segment called The 15-Minute Juice. It will be a continuation of the podcast, just in shorter clips, answering questions on physical therapy, rehabilitation, return to play after injury, training, and all things fitness. It's fast, it's concise, it's juicy. Welcome to the Coach Haas Podcast. Another beautiful day. You can see here, Mike. It is 82 and partly cloudy, and this palm tree is getting in my way a little bit. So I'm sure you're having the same weather up in Pennsylvania. And I think that as we go further north to where we have our guest from today, I believe she may be a little bit colder than the two of us, but we don't know. We'll check on the weather temperature, you know, when we introduce her here. We were just talking off the air as well. This is the third time we've had her on. So she is our first hat trick. So a little hockey term there. So that's going to kind of give it away on where she might be coming from. Mike, we want to welcome back on Dr. Anna. Dr. Anna is, she is a licensed, registered nutritionist, right? Mm-hmm. And then what am I missing there? I think there was a licensed dietitian.
Yep.
Gotcha. And Mike had some really big questions he wanted to ask, and then I started to jot down a couple things here. So just in case anyone has not heard the other two podcasts, can you just kind of give us a brief background of who you are and who you kind of help and who you're working with these days?
Yeah, I'm Dr. Anna Roby. I am a physiologist by training, and I'm also a registered dietitian. I studied nutrition in dietetics at Cornell, as well as exercise physiology. And then I went on to do a combined PhD RD program. So I was studying nutrition, doing my PhD, as well as kind of my dietetic internship to become a dietitian. And then I moved to Washington, D.C. I was working at NIH doing metabolic studies and research there. And now I kind of work in private practice, seeing clients, a lot of athletes, trying to work on performance nutrition and get them what they need. So,
gotcha. And where are you based out of now?
I'm based out of the Twin Cities area. So Minneapolis.
Gotcha. Minneapolis. Okay. So your temperature today is definitely not what mine is and probably not what Mike's is either. Right?
No, yeah. It's like 51 here right now.
Okay. Not too bad. Not too bad.
No, it's probably nice.
Yeah. Mike, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to have Anna back on. You know, this is a loaded bomb podcast here with all the knowledge she's about to drop.
Yep.
But yeah, the weather here, it's been getting 40s at night, kind of cold.
Okay. Okay. But, definitely, yeah. Definitely sweatpants and sweatshirt.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of miss it. I think I'll be up there within the next few weeks, though, having a little surprise visit. So I'll keep you posted on that. But I know that you had reached out to try to get this podcast to go again. I know you have some big questions that you want to ask. So I'm going to let you go first. I'm usually always stealing the show here and doing all the talking. I'm going to kind of have you take the floor and ask Anna a couple questions here, and then I'll go.
I think a good place to start off is, you know, we're working with a lot of these athletes that are anywhere from, you know, 11 years old now at this point, the injuries, all the way up to, you know, seniors in high school and then some college athletes. And a big gap in what we're trying to provide in the services is that nutrition foundation. There's just not enough education on really what these kids should be eating. And they're being pushed to performance extremes and their bodies are growing. And it's just an empty bucket that's not being filled. So I think maybe just a quick background as to just touching the bases there, Anna, as to why the nutrition is important, because it sounds like common sense for us, but for some of these parents are a little bit lost about, even for the kid, to understand the nutrition and why it's important for their performance as an athlete.
Yeah, no, that's a great place to start. Thanks, Mike. So nutrition is the kind of foundation of your performance in the sense that it is the energy that fuels your body. Every single cell in your body needs the nutrition coming in, whatever that is, you know, whether it's chocolate milk or peanut butter sandwich, that's going to fuel the cells in your body. And those obviously make up your organs, your tissues, and that's what's running your body. We're human beings. And so we're warm-blooded. We need to be taking in energy. We're constantly burning energy. And as you mentioned, you work with a lot of young athletes. So they're still growing. Even the college athletes, especially men, like their epiphyseal plates haven't fused yet. So their bones are still maturing. And so they're still growing. Their brains are still developing. And so the fuel that you're giving your body is going to determine to some degree how well it can function. Obviously, there are other elements that are going to impact that, but that's essentially kind of what's driving the engine. And so an analogy that's used a lot is like a car, right? You have to put gas in the car to allow it to run. And that's a pretty crude example, but that's kind of how humans are at a very basic level, is we need to put energy into our body so that they can run. And, you know, if you're putting glue in your car and your gas tank, it's not going to function very well. And so you have to have sort of the right fuel in order to optimally function at any age, but especially as a growing and, you know, performing athlete.
Can you talk about what the impact is of a poor nutritional plan, especially for these kids that are starting to hit puberty and growing, and that we know the demands of organized sports on them? And if they are just pushing forward with just running around, doing the sport, and then on top of, you know, not sleeping, what effects is it going to have on them if they're not dialing in their nutrition?
Yeah, it kind of depends on sort of how suboptimal their nutrition is, right? It's kind of a scale. And so, in the big picture, the number one thing, I think they're probably going to have fatigue. If you're not consuming enough energy, it's when we consume, you know, food is literally energy, right? That's what our cells use. And so if you're not eating enough, you're not going to have enough energy. And so I see a lot of athletes who are fatigued, you know, they're tired because they're not sleeping well enough, but then they're just not consuming enough to support their body's needs. Depending on kind of what they're not getting enough of, they could see stunted growth. They might not grow to be as tall as they would normally be if they had adequate nutrition. This is probably more extreme, but you can see some attention issues, possibly brain developmental issues if you have some pretty severe nutritional inadequacies. Oftentimes it can affect hair nail skin, so their hair can be a little, you know, thinner, finer. Maybe their hair, you know, even falls out to some degree. Brittle skin, nails. So you can see like sometimes bags under their eyes. Sometimes that can be related to B vitamin deficiencies in addition to just lack of sleep. For girls, you could see an irregular menstrual cycle or a missing cycle if they've started their period. And if you're working with the athletes that you mentioned, you know, kind of that sort of early teen, they would likely have started having a menstrual cycle. It's normal to have it be somewhat irregular when it first starts in a girl, but it should become more consistent as they, you know, as they get older. But if it starts to become more irregular or goes away, that's a huge problem that can have a negative impact on their bone development. And that's something that can cause really long-term damage. And it also can be stressful on the heart. We see the heart muscle can actually atrophy and become somewhat weak, as well as other, you know, connective tissue issues, and that's going to lead to more injuries, which you guys see all the time. So it's kind of a snowball effect. And so if you can start to sort of nutritionally rehabilitate someone, you will likely see changes in their mood. They likely are going to be in a better mood. I see a lot of, you know, crabby athletes who aren't, they're hangry, you know, not getting enough. So improvements in mood, physical appearance, possibly again, if they're skin becomes a little, you know, brighter, their hair is shinier, their nails are stronger, as well as their ability to, you know, focus and think clearly, as well as perform better too. If they're starting to see their performance decrease, if they're getting slower, if they're getting weaker, those are some really big red flags that there's something going on.
How would they notice that? I mean, other than the obvious, like what weaker, I mean, they're not being strength tested weekly. So, well, I mean, they technically could be if they were, you know, in a proper strength training program, but if they're not, how else would they be able to determine whether they were getting weaker?
I would say it's pretty subjective, but if they are having some kind of consistent workout, maybe it's a team lift once a week or, you know, something like that, they might think, you know, man, I used to be able to shoulder press the 15 pounds and now it feels really, really heavy. I can only do 10 pounds. And they start to notice that more than once. You know, we all have an off day, right?
Right.
But if they're starting to notice consistently, like, man, I used to be able to run, you know, 8 minute miles and now it's 8:30 pace, you know, those are some things that I think they might need to be aware of in terms of looking at their performance over a few weeks. If they notice that it's consistent, then that could be something to take note of.
So that's a great segue, because this is something that I really wanted to cover, is can we talk about, as you know, especially for a female athlete developing, nutritional demands probably based on their menstrual cycle or their growth, and then maybe some of that might be required for, you know, obviously a younger male growing, are there specific parts of that growth phase, maybe after like a peak height velocity stage where they kind of shoot up, or that growth spurt, that they would need certain nutritional demands, but definitely on the menstrual cycle with the females.
Yeah. So when you look at the research, you have what, you know, kind of these controlled studies, and we have certain findings that in the first half of the cycle, which is the follicular phase, this is where women are more insulin sensitive. So we tend to metabolize carbohydrates more easily. And so this is a great time to be getting plenty of, you know, complex carbohydrates. And that really can facilitate, you know, sprint work, weightlifting, things that are going to be using, you know, some stored carbohydrates in terms of an energy fuel source. So really making sure they're getting enough, as well as iron is really important, because that first week, the menstrual cycle starts the day that a girl starts her period. And so obviously if you're losing blood, you're losing iron, especially if they're, you know, a runner or some kind of endurance athlete, every time their muscles move, they're using iron. And so if you're exercising a lot and you're losing blood every month, you have really high iron needs. So focusing on iron-rich foods, and it's more than just red meat. I think that's kind of the first thing that people think of, but you can have other sources too. And then pairing that with some kind of fruit or like tomato product, because the acid is going to help improve the iron absorption. So those are kind of two things to emphasize early in the cycle. And then in the second half of the cycle, or the luteal phase, this is when we kind of shift and we start burning a little bit more fat at rest, and even at higher exercise intensities. And our metabolism actually increase a little bit as well. So you might notice that you're a little bit hungrier in the second half of your cycle. Most of that's due to hormones and not the elevated metabolism, but you do burn more energy at rest. So focusing more a little bit on protein, we tend to see higher protein breakdowns during this phase. It's really emphasizing the proteins as well as some of those, you know, kind of healthy fats. So things like avocados, nuts, seeds, those are great sources to kind of support that metabolism that's naturally burning through more fat. And that can also help keep you a little more satisfied. And it also helps to kind of stabilize blood sugar a little bit when you're pairing the carbohydrate with protein and fat. So you need protein, fat, and carbohydrates throughout, but kind of emphasizing a little bit more of the carbs in the first half and then a little bit more of the protein and fat in the second half. And I mean, maybe like a 10% flux. So it's not a lot. It's not big. If that stresses people out, then I just tell them, don't worry about it. You'll probably naturally gravitate towards those types of foods, you know, without even thinking about it. And so it's small. But if someone's looking to really kind of get that, sharpen that edge, those are some things that they can kind of look to do.
The biggest barriers that I feel like I get when I'm talking to the athletes about a diet is the first thing when they wake up, they're not hungry. So I don't know if there's strategies of what they could do or options they could do of like trying to get some fuel first thing in the morning. Yeah. I know sometimes when they're waking up at 5 a.m, they're not hungry unless, you know, they are accustomed to that, or their body is accustomed to that cycle. You know, you wake up and some people are hungry. Like I wake up in the morning and I'm starving, but for them, it's different. Or between those phases, like they're coming from practice and maybe they're going to come to PT, or they're going from school to practice. They don't really know what options of what to eat or how to time the eating. So then they have fuel. So they just don't eat. So I think those are the barriers of how they could tackle that. So the morning and then transition time. So do you have, what would you touch on with there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the morning is so important to get fuel in. And I hear this a lot from athletes too, is they say, well, I'm just not hungry. I don't eat breakfast, or I don't have time. And I tell them there are a lot of hard things about being an athlete. So, you know, you got to go to practice when you don't want to some days. And part of that is you have to eat when you're not hungry. And so even if they're not hungry in the morning, it's really important that they get some nutrition in, because that is going to start their day in terms of a fuel source. It's also going to help manage their hunger later on in the day. It's going to help give them a better workout or better focus in school if they're not having a workout in the morning. And so especially for girls and for women, it's really important, because not eating and then going sort of that fasting period can really mess with our hormones. And so having something is going to be really important. One nice thing, or kind of a cool thing, is that your body will get used to having food at a certain time. So if you're not hungry at 5 a.m. and you start eating something at 5 a.m., your body is going to get used to that and start to anticipate, hey, I'm not used to eating at this time. And so you will start to naturally develop an appetite for something around, you know, maybe 4:45 or whatever. You're like, oh, actually, I am a little hungry now. So it will get easier, is what I tell them. If they're not hungry, sometimes drinking something is less intrusive than eating. So smoothies are a great way to go. They can also, you know, bring them out the door with them. So they're, you know, pretty portable. And that's usually something that works well. You can fit kind of a full meal in a smoothie, you know, put in some yogurt or protein powder, some, you know, frozen spinach, some fruit, you know, some peanut butter. You've got everything you need in that drink. And it's easier to just sip something than it is to chew. So
right.
Liquids are a really good way to start. And then if you start to develop more of an appetite, you could have something kind of more solid if you want, but that would be a good kind of entry into eating first thing in the morning if you don't have an appetite. In terms of transitions between kind of school and practice, this is a tough time. I used to struggle with this when I was in school because it's like, man, it's, you know, I need something, but, you know, I can't really have something refrigerated because it's 3 p.m. I've been here since 6 a.m.
Yeah.
So you're kind of left scratching your head. So this is where you kind of have to do your best in terms of, like, if you don't have access to refrigeration and you can't have something like, you know, a smoothie. They do make some kind of like shelf stable drinks like chocolate milk, you know, you can get in the, you know, shelf stable little pouches. Something like that can work well with like a banana. So that way you get some carbohydrates, a little bit of protein and fat. But the main thing with that time period is carbohydrates, because that's what your body's going to be using for fuel. Something like a peanut butter sandwich can work if, you know, if it's not too high intensity, or if they have a little bit of time before practice. You know, peanut butter and jelly doesn't need to be refrigerated. But otherwise, you know, something like a banana, or even an apple, or the applesauce pouches, you know, something like that, that's going to, you know, stay with them in their backpack or locker or whatever, that's not going to spoil, can be helpful. There are some protein bars, some are better than others. But finding something that you like and sits well, you know, I don't have any like go-to, you know, brands or bars that I recommend because everyone is so different. I have some athletes who can't eat 2.5 hours before exercise or they lose it. Others could go for a run after Thanksgiving dinner. So it just depends on the athlete and kind of how intense their exercise is and what their stomach is comfortable with. So
that's Mike. Mike's running right after Thanksgiving dinner. I've seen him running down the streets of Newtown, and yeah.
No, I can't do the heavy meal. I did that one time when I was living out in Westchester. I ate pizza and then like went to the gym and lifted. I feel like I had a brick in my stomach.
Yeah. You know?
But you'll start also learning too. I tell us the athletes too, like that heavier digestion of eating heavier things, that's all blood into your GI tract. And as someone who does a lot of like running and all these type of OCR races, you don't have blood flow going to your legs, you're going to feel real sluggish. This workout is going to be horrible. Weightlifting, maybe a little bit different, like a little slower pace stuff. But if you have something heavy in your stomach, you just feel it. It feels like all the blood's there and nothing's getting to your extremities. You just feel horrible. So,
yeah. So if you're going to exercise within an hour, I usually recommend keeping it to pretty much just carbs. So, you know, like applesauce pouches work well. Spring energy gels are mm-hmm. nice. They're not actual gels. It's basically like a fruit puree. Or even like this sounds weird, but like the baby food pouches where it's like strawberry banana puree, it's just pureed fruit. Those work really well because it's going to get into your system really quickly. And like Mike said, it's not needing a ton of blood to go and digest the protein, the fat, because protein, fat, and fiber is going to slow digestion, which we want that after a meal because we want to stay, you know, full and comfortable. But if you're exercising soon, you do not want to slow digestion. So focusing on some of those kind of quicker carbs can be a lot more comfortable.
I remember Trent Nessler saying something on one of our podcasts there about the protein shakes, just mix it with water instead of milk before mm-hmm. because it's less to digest, a little bit lighter.
Yeah, that's true. Especially because milk is 80% casein, which is a slow digesting protein. So yeah, if you mix it with water, you're not adding any additional protein, that'll digest a lot faster. Again, it depends on kind of the exercise that you're doing, but every exercise is going to benefit from a carbohydrate source.
Does digesting the fruit as a blended smoothie, is it different than the actual fruit? I've heard this myth before that once the for instance, bananas and apples, once they get blended up, it's a different processing. And how does that go? I've heard people being more bloated after having like smoothies. What is your take on that?
Yeah, so what the smoothie does is it basically skips the mechanical digestion that occurs in the stomach. So your stomach is this bag that essentially just grinds everything up into like a puree. And then that leaves and goes into the intestines to be absorbed. So when you have a smoothie, it doesn't stay in the stomach nearly as long because it's like, well, hey, it's already digested. We can just go right to absorption. So it still keeps all of the components in the food. So I wouldn't say that it's worse for you. It's just already kind of mechanically digested. If someone's feeling bloated from a smoothie, I would, say what's in there. Oftentimes there's some, like artificial sweetener or some additive in the protein powder that can cause bloating. I mean, I've personally had that where there are some protein powders that just wreck my stomach and others are fine. So it could be an additive. I mean, if it's just fruit, are you drinking a lot of air with it? Are you gulping it? You could take a look at that because you are, blending some air into the food, but typically, you're not seeing any big differences in terms of, there's no difference in nutrition value.
And that comes down to using a trusted source for your protein powder, not just going into some store and buying something. So I try to tell a lot of kids in here, there's some trusted brands that I use, but going to Check My Sups or one of those it's another website where you could check basically what's in the proteins and all that to make sure it's quality stuff and it's not just whatever.
Yeah,
Interesting.
I think that's a good idea.
So, Joe, I know I had some. We had some kind of like a MythBuster questions. I know I had one athlete asking me some things, and these are questions that again they'll hear, they see it on Instagram or they see it on like MSN blog or a podcast, and I just say, look, you gotta really understand who you're listening to on the podcast. So, if maybe we kind of touch on some of these and see if they are true or part of it's true or if it's just complete BS.
Go ahead.
So I sent you some of those questions, Joe. You have them written down, or I could,
You know what? They were on my phone
yeah, there
and
was
I
really
was.
one, and I think it was about intermittent fasting, something
Yes.
about it being effective. I had, to help before a surgery. It was something about your white blood cells, it allows them to die off, so it makes new blood cells because old blood cells kind of stay there or something. Or really, it was a question about intermittent fasting and, is it effective before surgery or just overall? So maybe touch on that one and then maybe how that affects males and females differently. Because I know that's a hot topic.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, intermittent fasting I think is really fascinating. I convinced my advisor to let me do some intermittent fasting studies for my dissertation because I was interested in it. So I really kind of dove into this research. And I feel like it's kind of cooled off a little bit in the past few years, but you still get questions about it. So in terms of white blood cells, I think it's really going to depend on the person and their situation. As well as kind of their sort of baseline and what their metabolic health is. There are some studies in mice looking at white blood cell function. And white blood cells are your immune cells. So, you talk about you have a strong immune system. Your immune system is made up of these white blood cells. And so we obviously want to have a nice, strong, robust immune system. And when I looked at the research, there are some human studies that found lower immune cell function in healthy adults. You kind of have to interpret the literature carefully in terms of like, okay, so they have lower white blood cell counts. Is this because there's less inflammation and they don't need as many immune cells? Or is it that they no longer have sufficient energy intake and now their immune systems are weaker. So it's a little bit iffy in terms of the interpretation for some of these studies. I think in terms of overall, it looks like you want to have, I tell people, you want to have a smart distribution of your intake. So I think if you're a man, doing kind of confining your eating to, I usually do more than 8 hours, but I would say 12 hours is probably, you know, a good idea. Because really part of what intermittent fasting gets at is, circadian rhythm, which is just the natural kind of ebb and flow of our bodies, our cells functions. And we're not designed to be eating at night. Sometimes we have to, especially as an athlete, right? You get done at practice at 9 p.m., like you should have something. But for the general population, most people are just eating from the time they wake up until the time they go to bed. And so when you're eating 15, 16 hours a day, that can be problematic, especially kind of in that evening. So having some sort of, I guess, healthy eating pattern, with regards to, you know, eating right away when you wake up and then trying not to eat too late into the evening, with the exception of exercise, I think is generally going to be healthy. So with the white blood cells, I would mark that as a maybe, depends. It really depends on the person, and kind of what their starting point is. If you have someone that's really healthy and they start intermittent fasting and now their white blood cell function is decreasing, I would say that's probably not a good thing. But if you have someone that's maybe metabolically very unhealthy and now they're starting to pay more attention to their diet and their immune system is shifting as a result, that could be a positive.
The other part of that was, can intermittent fasting reduce, I think, type 2 diabetes, something with the insulin? And I thought maybe it was, well, again, it might have to be an individual specific. Are we talking about someone who is like, you look at how much Americans eat, the portion control, and it's like, is it reducing the amount of inflammation? Because we're not, you know, shoving Arby's and, you know, Chick-fil-A down our throat, you know, multiple times, and that's their intermittent fasting versus an athlete. Is this going to benefit them in terms of reducing risk of type 2 diabetes if you are, again, a female college soccer player? You know what I'm saying? So is it specific to the individual and lifestyle habit?
Yeah. So with the type 2 diabetes, most of these studies are in animal models. They use mice for a lot of these studies. And so that's a huge red flag. I wouldn't look at a mouse study and then try to implement something in your own life based on a mouse study. There are some human trials, but most of these trials are done in, you know, clinically defined obese individuals. And when they do intermittent fasting, they are eating fewer calories. And so I think it's more that their body is starting to kind of become more regulated metabolically. They're starting to lose excess.
From the calorie deficit, you're saying?
Yeah, it's more the calorie deficit and some of the excess fat that's being lost that's more beneficial than the actual intermittent fasting itself. There's done some really great studies a few years ago looking at, is it kind of the weight loss or is it the intermittent fasting itself? And they really found that, like, the intermittent fasting, there's nothing super magical about that. Most of the benefits we saw early research were from the weight loss. But again, I want to emphasize these were in people who really, you know, probably benefited from losing excess body fat, not young high school athletes. And so I really don't recommend intermittent fasting for athletes. There aren't benefits from intermittent fasting that you're not getting from exercise. Exercise is going to give you the benefits that some studies suggest could happen from intermittent fasting, and you don't get to double up. It's not like, well, if I exercise and I fast, I get twice the benefits. It doesn't work that way. You're kind of already checking the boxes with the exercise. And when you're working out, you're training, and now you're fasting, you are shortening your body's recovery window, essentially, because now I'm not giving you the fuel or the building blocks to recover. And so it's kind of like if you have to build a house in 24 hours, and 16 of those hours, you don't have any construction workers and you don't have any building materials, good luck getting your house built. So you really need to, you got to maximize your recovery time, especially because these athletes you're working with, they're training, you know, six days a week. They don't have a long turnaround time until their next training session or game. And so, or race. And so we really want to make sure that we're helping them recover and meet their energy needs, which they might not be meeting. And I don't recommend intermittent fasting for women. Like I said, it can really mess with our hormones. Women have a different response to intermittent fasting. We tend to see stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight. So we see an increase in cortisol, and then it can affect something called gonadotropin releasing hormone, which has downstream effects on the ovaries and can cause irregular and missing menstrual cycles. So I usually don't recommend it for athletes, and especially not for women.
So you know what? We would definitely have we would have athletes definitely trying to do both of those, right? Like, yeah, I'm going to work out and I got to intermittent. Like, yeah, like they're definitely could see that happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of that, how about a cleanse? We're talking about like flushing systems and resetting and all that stuff. Are cleanses effective? Do they work? Are they dangerous? Is it a myth? What do you think of that?
Oh, that's such a great question. I love this. No to the cleanses. There's not a single piece of, you know, valid scientific
marketing
support that shows that a cleanse is benefit. And let's think about this. I tell people, if you have a liver, if you have skin, and if you have a kidney, preferably two, your body is cleansing. And a cleanse can actually have the opposite effect. Because let's think about this. Okay, so if our liver, our kidneys, and our skin is always detoxifying and pulling out things that our body really doesn't want or need, those filter systems, right, those three organs, those need to be functioning well. And if now we're not giving them what they need to function, you're messing with your body's natural detox system. So usually they're low in the vitamins and minerals that they need to function well. So like B vitamins, for example, in the liver. Now you've taken out these vitamins that it needs to work, and now your liver's not really functioning super well. You're actually kind of causing the opposite effect that you want. It's really harmful in terms of it's very low in usually protein and fat and other essential nutrients that you need to survive. It doesn't have any benefit in terms of long-term weight loss. A lot of people will think like, oh, I'm going to, you know, lose 5 pounds. It's like, well, yeah, because you're drinking celery water for 3 days. And as soon as you go back to eating whatever you were eating, you know, the weight is just going to come back on. So there really isn't any benefit. And it can be quite dangerous. You can have low levels of electrolytes, which can cause some, you know, just general dizziness, possibly fainting, or even if in extreme cases, like a heart arrhythmia. So I do not recommend cleanses, detoxes of any sort. Eating generally a good diet, right? Mostly real food, a wide variety, you're going to have the best sort of detox capacity that you can.
Okay.
That's a great explanation.
Yeah, it is. I have three different ones. I'll go one and then I'll have Mike go back again unless he doesn't have one. Magnesium. Okay. And asking about magnesium, not just the supplement to take, but is it in foods that we can also get it from?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think that magnesium is one thing that is higher on the supplement list in terms of like it can be beneficial for athletes. It's an essential electrolyte, and it's involved in over 300 chemical processes in the body. And we lose it through sweat. And so obviously if you're sweating a lot, you're losing a lot. Focusing on fruits, vegetables, nuts and seeds, beans, those are all going to be great sources of magnesium. So having, you know, getting your produce in is going to be really helpful for meeting those magnesium needs. But trying to emphasize those, you know, foods. And if you need a supplement, you know, if you notice cramping, you know, that can be a sign that you could benefit from magnesium.
How many milligrams a day would you recommend?
It depends on, it kind of depends on what they're getting from the diet. I usually recommend starting low and then sort of gradually increasing it to what they feel like they're benefiting from. So, you know, looking for an intake of at least 300 milligrams per day, especially with, you know, that counts your diet plus supplements getting to that. You want to be careful if you're using like magnesium citrate, that can have like a laxative effect. So I would gradually increase that, you know, maybe starting with like 100 milligrams and going from there.
Why would you use a citrate over like the biglycinate or whatever that one? Is there a difference between two?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily recommend the citrate. I just mentioned that to like kind of warn people if they are choosing that one. There are different forms and they kind of can play different roles. But yeah, the variety of different kinds can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
I just would recommend staying away from magnesium oxide. That's a really cheap form. It's not very well absorbed, so you're not really going to get a whole lot out of that one. So I would avoid that one. If they have a sensitive stomach, I would go for magnesium lactate. That's usually a little more gentle in the stomach, because some of the magnesium forms can cause stomach upset. So,
gotcha. And I think the one I'll add in here, since we had some segues into it earlier, but kind of just going back and explaining, especially for, you know, some of these athletes that are, you know, coming right out of surgery, you know, Trent talked a little bit about this, but the importance of the nutrition during this part. And we developed, you know, an ACL nutrition program, but just to revisit this topic. So why that nutrition is important post-op, because, you know, the kids think that they're not working out or doing a lot of strenuous stuff, so they don't need to eat as much. And also if we're doing things like using blood flow restriction training and such, why they need that hydration and nutrition to be where it is.
Yeah, so when you are coming out of a surgery, you're going to have quite a bit of inflammation, which is a good thing at that point, because inflammation is, it gets a bad rap, but it's basically your body's smoke signal to say, hey, we need a little extra help and attention over here. We've got some tissue that we need to repair. So your body's got a lot to do. It has to repair the tissue. It might need to, you know, heal blood vessels, and other, you know, possible connective tissues. But healing process is very time intensive, and it starts as soon as the damage occurs, right? As soon as they cut you open from the surgery, like that's when the recovery process is going to start. And it's not like you can say, okay, I need you to pause, and then you can start healing again in 6 months when the season is over. It's gonna, you know, it's got its own time course. And so we have to optimize that recovery process with the nutrition, because the nutrients are going to be the energy and the building blocks to repair that tissue. If you don't have enough, you're not going to see optimal recovery. You could see scar tissue form instead of, you know, the healthy connective tissue, because the body's like, well, I have to do something and I don't have what I need. So this is what you got, right? So you're just going to see, yeah, excessive scar tissue formation. And that could impair possible, you know, function or use depending on what the surgery was. So it's, I think it's kind of natural to think, well, I'm not exercising. I really don't need to eat as much because I, instead of working out for an hour, I'm sitting on the couch. But when you look at your energy needs over a day, that exercise is the second smallest fraction of your energy needs. It doesn't sound like it. You might think, well, of course, running for an hour is going to use a lot of energy. But when you look at how much energy your body needs just at rest and to do what it needs to do to function, that exercise really isn't that big of a piece of the puzzle. So, and instead you have this tissue repair, which is using a lot of energy to repair. So again, think of like a construction site. If you're repairing a road, you have to have construction men or women to lay the building blocks to do the repair in the process. And if you don't have the workers, it doesn't get done. And so you really need to have that energy and those nutrients, those building blocks to repair that tissue. So I tell people, okay, you're not working out, but your body is still working on overdrive, trying to recover and repair. So there really is very little difference in your nutritional needs. And so maybe it's as simple as like, you don't have your pre-workout snack, right? Maybe they were having the applesauce pouch before practice. They're not having practice, so they don't need the applesauce pouch, but they're still having their normal meals anyways. So it can be counterintuitive, but it's so important that they eat sufficient calories. You can always do body recomposition later. That is not time specific, but you only have one chance to heal post-op. So really prioritize that.
That's a great point. Trying to focus on that recovery and the important things, and we could get that body composition back later down the line. There's plenty of room to make that. That's awesome. Yep. Here we got time for probably one more there, Joe. Let's make it a good one, right?
All right. All right. Pressure's on now. Salt water, collagen.
Oh, those are good ones. So we really need more. I'll start with the salt water since you asked that first. I would say for most people, it's not necessary. We have a pretty high salt intake and sodium content in our food supply. But if someone is noticing that they're, when they pee, that they have totally clear urine, that can be a sign that they're overhydrated, and salt can help kind of pull more of that water in. But I would say for most people, probably don't need the salt water. You're probably going to get enough from the food that you eat. Most of the time there's salt in any sort of product. If it's plain fruit, you know, vegetables or whatever, maybe you salt your food, a little pinch of salt is fine. So yeah, I would say probably not.
About the, also with the salt, now there's the, obviously, you know, your table salt, white. Mm-hmm. How about like your pink Himalayan salt? I mean, I've heard doctors talking about this, you know, doing that in the morning, first thing in the morning, you know, having one of these packets. I know, again, it could be a little bit about marketing, but I've heard several people talking about that. What is your take on that?
So I think this ties back into a couple of things. One, you should be eating breakfast when you get up, or at least like a, you know, smoothie or whatever. And so assuming that your snack or meal has some sodium in it, that's going to be helping to pull the water into your cells. So it's not just going right through you. So again, making sure that you have kind of balanced meals, you've got some sodium and other electrolytes in there, works well. But in terms of the kind of pink Himalayan salt, they're both sodium. The one benefit with like kind of the white table salt is it's iodized, and iodine is an essential nutrient. It's important for our thyroid health. And so if you're not using iodized salt, the other sources of iodine are like seaweed and dairy products. So if you're, you know, not consuming dairy, I'm assuming they're not eating seaweed, you want to make sure that you're not going to get, you know, an iodine deficiency, don't get a goiter. And so that is something to consider. So I would say, you know, just kind of be mindful of that. There are some other like tiny trace elements, I think, with some of the other, you know, sea salt, pink Himalayan salt, but I'm talking so, so minuscule that it's really not going to make any difference.
Okay. All right. And then I guess the last one was the collagen. And yes. do we need more of that? And then, you know, what type of foods would we see that in that would help?
So collagen really needs more research. There's pretty limited research on it. And some of the studies we do have are funded by the collagen supplement companies, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad research. It just means that you should probably be a little more critical of it, because it's like, well, it's a little sketchy if your funding is the supplement company. But with the collagen, I don't think it's worth adding in terms of, you know, some women take it for like hair, skin, and nails. I haven't seen anything super compelling with that. But with athletes, it can be helpful in terms of connective tissue, so tendons, ligaments, you know, especially like post-op. I think that could be a good time to take it. Natural foods that it's going to be found in are gelatin and bone broth. You can obviously buy collagen supplements. There isn't really a downside besides the cost of it. It's not like it's got side effects. You're not going to throw off your biochemistry. So it's a pretty safe supplement in that regard. But it can be fairly pricey. So I would say if you are doing lots of, you know, jumping, running, you know, plyometric type work, it might be worth using if it's, you know, if that's something that's of concern. But I wouldn't take it from just like a average Joe off the street trying to avoid wrinkles kind of a thing. I don't think there's anything.
I had an amazing chef up in Pennsylvania, and he had the bone broth, which was fantastic. And I keep, matter of fact, I texted him yesterday. He hasn't gotten back to me. I asked him, I said, have you finally figured out a way to ship this down to me? I mean, I'm telling you, when I, the last time I was up there, that was my first phone call. I called him. I said, I need, you know, 2 quarts of that while I was back. It's because I've tried so many different ones. It's awful if you don't find the right one. And his is homemade and it was delicious. And I can't get it down here. So I do use a, you know, a supplement company, and, you know, I do the powder in the mornings. To be quite honest, I see it in my nails. I mean, I'm bald, so I don't really see, my hair's not necessarily growing back. You know, I guess maybe with my training, I don't do an enormous amount of plyometrics, maybe once a week. So I can't really tell that way. Do you take a supplement for that, Mike?
No. Maybe I should try playing around because I do plyometric stuff. So see how it works, you know. I find for me the biggest thing is the hydration. That has to be on point. If that's not on point with the type of training I do, you know, when you feel sluggish and it doesn't work, or you just feel, you know, so. Yeah,
I think it's pretty low on the list of priorities. And it, like I said, it is, I think it can be kind of expensive depending on the brand you get. So yeah. I certainly wouldn't, you know, if a high school athlete came to me and like, what should I be doing? I really wouldn't recommend it unless they're having, you know, specific issues that I think it could benefit from. But like you said, Mike, hydration, you know, just like general nutrition practices, sleep, like that's going to get you 98% of what you need.
Right.
This was awesome. This was about an hour worth of extreme knowledge that's going to be so beneficial. And that's why we do this, just getting this information to the community, the parents, the kids, surgeons, coaches. This stuff is not even being touched. I have parents coming in, and they are clueless about any of this. No, they just don't talk about this. They just want to push these kids to performance. And it's just, you know, we've had multiple guests on this podcast talking about they just can't see past the sport specific, kicking the ball, hitting the racket, and don't understand that human performance entails all these other entities. And I mean, you have people that aren't even really athletes themselves, you know, making decisions based on this. I mean, it's wild. So as still an athlete myself, I understand the importance of all these things and dialing it in. So this is just, it's just stuff that's just invaluable right here, you know?
Yep. Once again, you know what, actually now I was just thinking as you were talking, I think now we have to, now that we have our hat trick, our series, we're going to have to do the Dr. Anna series and put that on our YouTube channel. So they can watch one right after the other.
Yeah, we could do that and start getting more of a mastermind, like round table, where we could somehow line up a couple of the specialists together talking about some of the major issues going on in this country with, you know, youth and adolescent sports and just overall performance, and having a bunch of different, you know, people chiming in on the different aspects of what they specialize in and being able to help share that, kind of like that round table type thing. Or who knows, maybe as we try to get some seminars and stuff going, maybe we can, you know, invite someone like you out, Anna, to do something, you know. And that's kind of the big goal here, because the education piece for all this stuff is just, it's not there. It's, you know, what cleat are we buying, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, after being at the Vertimax Summit over the weekend, there is, you know, and especially now that everyone is definitely, you know, come back around and getting together, I think that would be a great idea, even if we, you know, we did something on a smaller scale where we did it on the Facebook Live, you know, on our ACL Return to Play Academy page. And then, you know, if we could ever get something together where we can get everyone in the same room, that would be amazing. That would really be cool. So Dr. Anna, thanks again for your time. We appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll see you for a fourth time at some point down the road.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I have your information in the clinic. So, you know, I refer people to that. So hopefully they will reach out, at least for some consultations or an intro call, and just, you know, just learn from you.
How would they find you?
Oh, they can just email me. It's just Anna@DrAnaRobi.com. And I love chatting with people, so I encourage people to reach out.
Mike, where can they find you?
Mike St. George on LinkedIn, Instagram, HoneyBadger_Juicy, and Facebook.
There you go. All right. You can find me at Coach_Haas and Joe Haas on LinkedIn, Coach Haas on Facebook, and then Coach Haas on YouTube to find all of our podcasts, our exercises, all kinds of stuff. Like I said, I'm still having trouble getting our other podcast from Friday up on YouTube, but that will be up there along with this episode. Dr. Anna, thanks again. Have a great day, guys.
Take care.
All right. Talk to you later.